Hi, I'm Jacob Halbrin, the editor of the National Interest, and it's my great pleasure to have my longtime friend and colleague, Sam Tannenhaus, on this podcast in the National Interest. Sam worked for many years at the New York Times, both on the op-ed page and as the book review editor, and he has now completed the masterwork that everyone has been waiting for, a biography of William F. Buckley Jr. that's attracting an enormous amount of attention, also extremely timely as it arrives at the outset of the second term of a Trump presidency. Sam, welcome aboard.
Great to be here, Jacob. I thought we were going to talk about the New York mayoral race. There's your revolution.
We can talk about that too. So William F. Buckley himself ran for mayor of New York, as you chronicle in your book and was originally excerpted in the New York Times Magazine. What similarities or differences do you see today between those two races?
Wow, what an excellent transition. I can tell you've been doing this for a long time. I toss out the Mom Downey thing, and here we are with Buckley. Actually, what do? They run as super outsiders, and they put together coalitions nobody thought were there, right? So with Bill Buckley, it's funny, these have become antiquated terms, but back in the day, they were called white ethnics, because not all white people were considered alike back then. So he attracted a lot of Catholic voters, a lot of Italian and Irish, not so many Jewish voters, and put together an unusual coalition of outer borough support, which was kind of fun and surprising because, although he actually lived in Connecticut and didn't think he could run at first because he paid lower taxes in Connecticut, that's where I live there, he did have an apartment in Manhattan, but it was on the Upper East Side. So this was very much a kind of high society guy for all his populist as it emerged politics. And then we look at our new guy here, who's 33. Buckley, by the way, was 39 when he ran. So here we have this 33-year-old who, I was looking at the New York Times map today. I'm sure you were too, Jacob. What do you make of the coalition he's putting together, this new guy?
It's quite amazing. And I think it does, you know, the Democrats now are wondering if it's their model for the future, just as Buckley and the crew around him helped create a new electoral model based on the Southern strategy for the Republican Party.
Well, yeah. I mean, here's one thing I'll just toss out there, and this is an unformed thought, so I don't want any of your erudite listeners to jump to conclusions, because this is just something that, you know, flitted across my old guy's brain, is that, all right, so for a long time now, we've been hearing that, from some, that our current president runs on a kind of white resentment, white resistance politics, what in Buckley's day was called the backlash politics, term invented in the early 60s to describe the white backlash against black gains in the North as the civil rights movement proceeded up the latitudes. Well, now I see, looking at Mom Downey, that he's not attracting much black support. The black support went for Andrew Cuomo. Now, does that mean it will later go for Eric Adams? I don't know. But here's the other thing. So I would add two things to that. Something that's been kind of kicking around for a while that we can't all wrap our minds around. The base, the foundation, the strength, the core of the Democratic Party for many years now has been black voters. And we're getting the message they are some of them are the party's new conservative. So they hold a position kind of like the old core of the Republican Party. And consider this too, Jacob, if Andrew Cuomo stays in the race, which he may well do.
I don't think he actually will, because he defeated so thumpingly. I think he's aged out. Let's be honest. This is a generational change.
Yeah, very interesting. Because what I was going to say is, if he stayed in,
and I don't mean to make you feel bad, because I know you're 3 years older than Cuomo, but
well, thanks for reminding me. Thanks for checking the calendar, man. But here's the thing I was going to say, but you just blown it to smithereens. Is you could also have a three-man race, man. I emphasize still after all these years, as you had in Buckley's race, and Buckley's idea was, you know, he was going to be this wedge guy and drive through and get it, the poor 5'2" accountant from Brooklyn, a beam elected. Instead, he got the kind of, you know, Kennedy wannabe John Lindsay elected, though he ultimately destroyed, ruined Lindsay's career. But if you had the three guys running now, that would be really interesting. And I have a feeling, see, Adams is the one who could make this thing work. I have to say, now that my wife and I have been living for 10 years in rural Connecticut, New York feels a little remote. So I kind of follow it as an outsider. But I was poring over that map today that the Times had. You know, the Times may no longer be at, let's say, the top of their game when it comes to their pros, but their numbers are still pretty good, I think. And it looked like you had these pockets of support and all these unexpected places. And the thing that Wright has been saying for a long time, J.D. Vance is really effective at making this case, and others, Bannon too, is, well, the Democrats are the parties of the elite and all that. Well, you can characterize the elite in many different ways. What's interesting is just to look at this coalition. So you see middle class and upper class people, they're saying, the Times is saying, went for the new guy. Asians and Latinos kind of went for the new guy. And you have the black support that looks like it's, you know, more comfortable with Cuomo, the old style Democrat, the big money, the labor unions. And it really is one of these fascinating moments. Although we know, as who used to say back when I was, even when I was young, New York is not America. Who used to say New York is not America? I forget who it was. But it is a little different. So you don't want to make.
But Sam, more. I would say I am not completely surprised by what could be described, I think, in New York as the backlash to the backlash. I have been waiting for the discontent in America, which has been rumbling now for over a decade, with elites and with the economy, to manifest itself in the Democratic Party. Because, you know, the Republican Party became radicalized. But it seemed logical to me, and I think this will occur, that among the Trumps will be unable to fulfill the aspirations of his followers. And that discontent, far from subsiding in America, is only going to grow greater over the next few years. And to me, this election in New York feels like a harbinger of that.
Yeah, that is the big question. It's entirely possible. And I'll just throw a couple of things out about that. And one thing I really like about your take on politics, Jacob, is you really do follow a rational actor model. That is to say, look at Trump voters and you ask, because I know it's America, this guy and I are in like an almost continual conversation. So one of the questions that comes up is, what do Trump's voters actually expect of him? What level of expectation do they hold him to? Because one thing that's almost without precedent, it seems, is that there are no expectations. He can change his mind on a dime. He can change his policy on a dime. He can pivot, you know, very quickly within the space of a sentence, and his voters are there with him. And so that raises the question of whether they're looking at other things in a candidate that doesn't have to do with explicit promises or implicit promises. Yet we also know gasoline prices start going up too high and Americans aren't too happy about it. And so, you know, you come back to an argument like that. One thing I would add, you know, since, you know, I'm the historical parallels guy, just the like this Walter Mitty figure stuck in antiquity, is that I'm reminded how in 1968, that volatile year, Richard Goodwin wrote a great piece in The New Yorker about it. It was sort of a curtain raiser for Nixon coming in 69, in which he said a lot of people who had intended to vote for Robert Kennedy, who was assassinated, instead supported George Wallace, the radical populist from the South. And that goes to your thesis that there is a discontented vote that could be harnessed by either side. Bernie Sanders got there very early. You know, there are some who still maintain this is the unsung, you know, prophet of our politics with Sanders. I remember a piece, it was George Packer did, at the time of the 2016 election when he was still at The New Yorker, talking to Trump voters and Sanders voters and seeing where the overlap was back then. So it could well be that we are looking at a new populism on the left, a radical populism on the left, which we know a lot of people want. A lot of people on the left who are really tired of the Democratic Party. It's interesting how all this stuff repeats itself. You read the little description of Cuomo's campaign and you almost can't believe it. It's hundreds of millions being poured in by rich guys. It's locking up the unions, you know, and never, it's
what,
promises.
There's, what's so attractive about a guy who was accused of making unacceptable sexual advances towards 11 women? I mean, he's old, he's mired in scandal, discredited. I mean, what's the pull? You can see that he was an old, faded establishment candidate, and the gas has gone out of the Democratic establishment. The gas has gone out of Chuck Schumer. There's gonna be a purge in the Democratic Party.
Interesting. Well, and then as soon as I told my wife, I said, well, Bill Clinton came in and endorsed Cuomo. She said, that's it for him. Like, the last person you want to hear from at this point. Not that Clinton was anything but a competent and accomplished president. You know, he was really good in many respects. Nevertheless, he's so old at this point. I mean, there are people running around older than I am. You're right, Andrew Cuomo is not, but some of his supporters are. It does feel exhausted. And they're still not getting the message of the real rebellion. You know, I interviewed, as you know, Jacob, because I stayed with you when I went to Washington, interviewed Jamie Raskin for a story I've got coming out soon, Vanity Fair. And he, I understood it when he said, I mean, he's a very likable and bright guy. And he said, well, the Republicans didn't just win, we lost. So they're always going to go back to the map and say, well, we could have done X and Y a little bit differently. Or you look at this spate of books coming out that's all about the gossip in the Democratic Party. You know, if so-and-so had made that phone call 10 minutes earlier, we'd be looking at President Kamala Harris and all of this stuff. And you think there is something really, really amiss in how politics is being run and administered, right?
And might I say, written about. If you look at the New York Times today, to pick on our favorite newspaper, there the article is filled with far left this, far left that, Democratic Socialists of America fringe, no one's ever heard of it. Nonsensical. It is the counterpart of the neoconservative movement. It's just never gotten footage in America, but it's the equivalent of a German or a Swedish social democrat. We're not talking about Bolsheviks trying to storm the American equivalent of the Winter Palace. And our good friend Matt Sittman, for example, is also on the board of Dissent, Democratic Socialist. It's not an extremist ideology.
I know. And you go all the way back to one of Bill Buckley's best friends in his last years, George McGovern, who was a prairie populist called a communist. Buckley did some of the communist name calling. I know it happens all the time. And we...
George McGovern flew bombing raids over Munich in World War II. This guy was not a pacifist. He was, you know, a patriotic American.
Yeah, he came out of the same wing of the party as Henry Wallace, Eleanor Roosevelt. The left wing is a prairie populist wing of the Democratic Party, and you treat it as if it's some kind of alien, you know, incubus or something. It's crazy. And you're right. That is the problem with, what shall we call it, our kind of establishment discourse, you know, rodomontade, as Buckley would have called it. And it really does feel so thin. Here's another thing. So my wife and I are sitting, we go to this coffee place every morning out here in Connecticut. And she said, is there a Republican candidate? And there is, Curtis Sliwa. You have to dig pretty deeply in the New York Times coverage to see that there actually was a guy who won the Republican nomination, you know? And you would just think, as a matter of due diligence, you put it out there. Not that anyone expects him to win. Nevertheless, there he is. And it's, you know, we've had this conversation. I said, you and I have had it. I've had it with many others too, including in the days when I was at the New York Times. The idea that the New York Times is a conspiracy, or, you know, a phrase I use in my book, coordinated duplicity, is untrue. That it's an echo chamber Well, maybe.
Well, yeah, when I was trying, I wasn't trying to, the Times has trouble, the mainstream media has trouble with ideological movements. They are foreign to it. It can be far right, far left, whatever it is. It's very difficult for the media to grasp that candidates can be motivated by ideas that are separate from fundraising or from the mainstream. That's my take at any rate.
Yeah. And you know what I would say to that, Jacob, is what that great genius Gary Will said about it all those years ago. What they think is kind of consensus or non-ideological or beyond ideology is its own ideology, right?
Of course it is.
That's what our friends like Matt Sittman and John Gans, you know, all these guys we're kind of hanging out with now and learning from, because they're even younger. They're younger even than you. They're going to tell you, what do you mean? Of course it's ideology, only you pretend it's something else. And I'll say that
the minute someone says, I'm not ideological, that is an ideological statement.
That's it. It's like in those great John Updike novels, you know, the rabbit novels. And he has that one in the most underrated of them, the fantastic Rabbit Redux. And they're fighting about Vietnam, and Rabbit says, you know, I don't care about politics. It's my American right not to care about politics. And then he launches into a defense of American Vietnam. And because it's like, you know, the psychopathology of politics in our lives, and social media enhances it, but it hardly created it. Kind of a gateway thing, and you get sluiced through, and suddenly it's all politics all the time. Well, I do think you're right, and I would add to that that is partly the doing of that establishment media we're talking about, and not just media. It's also you know, Buckley's famous joke that everybody's, repeating now about Harvard and the 2000, first 2000 names in the Boston telephone directory would make more sensible leaders than the 2000 members of the Harvard faculty, which is, by the way, a more complex statement than is given credit for. In fact, I noticed George Orwell essentially says the same thing in his famous essay on James Burnham, which my wife and I reread the other night, where he says, Orwell says, you remember this, Jacob, because you know all this stuff. He said, during World War I, it was always the educated elites who would say, Germany's going to win, England can't stand up to them. And it would be the guy in the street who'd say, well, what do you mean? No one's going to beat us. We're going to win the war. And Orwell spins out some interesting explanations for this. One of them is a kind of pessimism. He's a great line in there. He says something like, if you have more imagination, then you can envision these catastrophic ends, right? Well, but aside from all of that, I think the real crime, or call it an intellectual crime, or at least malfeasance, is this idea that our great institutions are not ideological. And that's how Buckley made his attack on Yale way back when. It's the attack that's still being made today. And then somebody pulls the curtain away and says, here's what they're teaching in the classroom. Here's what their professors publish. Here's what students come out parroting. Like, that's what I saw at the New York Times, is you encounter these very bright young people, like vastly smarter than I ever was. I can tell you, I was not Ivy League material then or later, but they come out parroting what's essentially, you know, a kind of ideological groupthink, and that does penetrate the wider culture. And you're kidding yourself if you think it doesn't. You know,
tell us a little about Buckley in his early years and how much of that lives on. You know, before you in your biography, you spend a lot of time on his father, William Sr., and the avidity of the family for the America First movement, the father's hostility to the New Deal, which he saw as tantamount to Bolshevism, his antipathy toward Jews, who he saw as wily, slippery creatures. And the Bill Jr. absorbed much of this ethos. And in fact, the family itself was kind of an echo chamber, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And in his later years, I don't mean really later years, but when he was entirely mature, you know, in his early 40s, and his father had long died, 10 years after his father died in 1958, Bill Buckley said, I was proud to be my father's echo chamber when he was young. There were 10 kids. The father was really brilliant. And I had so many pages on him that I couldn't include in the book. And several chapters on his early history. So let me talk about that a little bit, because I'm still trying to get it out there somehow. Maybe I'll just put it online.
For all his flaws, was the father more mature than Bill Buckley ever was?
He was more disciplined and serious. For instance, when the father grew up in Duval County, Texas, right, just north of Rio Grande Valley, less than 100 miles from Mexican border. And everyone knows the Duval County because it was the group of towns that gave Lyndon Johnson his, you know, stolen election, Democratic primary victory for the Senate in 1948 and sent him on the path to the White House. And that's significant, Jacob, because it was a heavily Tejano community. And the difference between being a really poor Tejano in South Texas and being a poor Black American in South Carolina, where the Buckley family had their second home, is the Tejanos could vote. You know, there was no literacy test for them. You know, none of that regime of voter suppression that it came out was present in the South and forced in the South for so long. So the father, who was born in 1881, I think it was, and made his career in Mexico. He went there rather than to try to succeed in the northern cities as his parallel figure, Joe Kennedy, did, which strikes me as interesting. Kennedy's kind of Boston Irish, and he made his career at Cambridge, Boston, and New York was always looked down on as a Catholic. Buckley Sr. came from a Catholic region of Texas, went to Mexico, where the Catholic intellectuals were the elite. And his friends there were what were called the cientificos in that era. They were the technocrats, multilingual intellectuals. Buckley Sr. read Cervantes in Spanish. He went on discipline reading programs, traveled through Europe, took his kids, Bill and his siblings. He lived in Europe for 4 years. That's why he learned English so late and why he had that unusual way of speaking. And that he would have said that lust for polysyllabic words, you know, an ornate syntax. So all that poured into him from his youth, but they were also super reactionary. So there's a very interesting man who comes out of the kind of 50s and 60s in the American right, Carl Hess, a right winger who went far left, classic libertarian, who said, Bill Buckley wasn't a conservative. He was a Spanish aristocrat. And when you look at it that way, then it all seems very different. You have this hierarchical society. People know their place. You worship next to anyone in the pew because everyone is admitted to heaven together. It's just that while we're living this unimportant earthly life, some people may have millions and others starving in the streets, right? So that, you know, that's that evangelical capitalism thing. Buckley grew up in it. One of the most interesting reviews of God and Man at Yale, the book everyone is talking about now. And that was striking to me because I think it's the most important book he wrote at the age of 25. When I read, as you know, there's been a lot of commentary on my book. It's almost always about God and Man at Yale. No one mentions the other books. He wrote 50 other books. Some of them are quite wonderful. That's the one they talk about. Well, what's he doing there? He is reviving that old view of the economy and of Christianity. So one of the sharpest reviewers, most astute, was Peter Viereck, whom you know was a figure, was one of the older new conservatives, as they call them, very centrist figure, whose father had been a Nazi agent. So he's suspicious of ideology too. And he said, why are people saying that, he said this in the New York Times, why are people saying that Buckley's book is accusing people of being communists? He's not accusing them of being communists. He's accusing them of being New Deal liberals, which is an even graver sin, right? So that's old right American politics. That's
now, we should also note that in McCarthy and His Enemies, which was a defense of McCarthyism as opposed to an outright defense of Joseph McCarthy, Buckley and L. Brunt Bozell, towards the end, I believe, comment that when we have finished with the communists, we will turn our attentions to the real enemy, the liberals.
And you and I both love that. We both quote that all the time.
That to me, though, is fairly significant. It does seem like we are now, you know, Trump today in his press conference at, you know, he's at the NATO meeting, referred explicitly, right. He said CNN is scum, New York Times is scum, MSNBC is scum. And he said, I know there are some good reporters in here, but there's a lot of scum. So what's he talking about? He's talking about the liberals.
He is talking about the liberals. Right. Buckley has that line from after he'd been this like impossibly brilliant student journalist at Yale. And I've been, you know, going around talking to people. And I say, you can make the case Bill Buckley was the greatest campus journalist of the 20th century. I mean, he was famous in the way we would think of someone being famous before he left Yale.
Because he was a contrarian and a provocateur.
Yeah, and a really, really clever writer. And yes, he was all those things. And at one point, so when you were the chairman of the Daily News, it was so hard to untangle this. I had a copy editor who pointed out, you know, you got to straighten it out a little bit. And I think finally I did. So what happened is you run to become the head of the Daily News. It's a competition. They called it Healing with two E's, not healing in the kind of wellness sense, but actually dog obedience, because the older guys, all guys back then, right? Yale doesn't become co-ed, remember that old term, till 1969. Buckley's there almost a quarter century before then. It's all guys in suits and ties. And you have a competition, the Healing competition, to see who's going to be the top dog at the newspaper. Buckley wins it. So that's his first year. That means for two semesters, second semester of his junior year, first semester of his senior year, he's the big guy writing the editorials every day. And so then he cedes it to the next guy, but he's still writing for the paper and writing letters. And one of them, he says, liberals are a far italicized, greater danger than communists. And he got that from his mentor, a guy we've both written about. You've written about him especially well in a number of contexts. The crazy genius Wilmore Kendall told him that. Don't worry. Yeah, the communists are there. They're great. It's great to call them names. It's great to stir up a lot of hatred against them. But the ones you want to take down are what the term they invented at National Review, they coined it, the liberal establishment. Capital L, capital E. They came up with that.
People like Arthur M. Schlesinger Jr., John Kenneth Galbraith, all the apostles of the New Deal who supported it during the Kennedy administration and tried to further liberalism.
Jack Kennedy was elected in one of the narrowest victories of the 20th century. He won by barely 100,000 votes. And as we know, some of those votes were contested quite plausibly in places like Cook County in Illinois. And they act as if they've won a landslide. He did not get 50% of the vote. He did about as well as President Trump did the second time around, and they acted as if it was a massive victory. That is not just a Democratic problem, because you remember George W. Bush and Dick Cheney did the same thing. They also, you know, kind of hijacked an election and then acted as if they had this enormous mandate. And Wilmore Kendall was one of the first to say and argue in a sophisticated way, as his colleague at the Yale Political Science Department, Robert Dahl, also said, there's no such thing as a mandate. It doesn't exist. You know, it's a slogan that's been invented. And I think, Jacob, I'll be interested to hear your thoughts on this, because you do a lot more theory than I do. I'm too dumb for theory. I just try to find out where the fun stories are. How often in our politics, slogans and ideas kind of get murkily tangled up. And so an idea begins to feel like a slogan, and a slogan gains some of the kind of, you know, aura of an idea. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Well, this will take us into a whole thicket of the extent to which ideas are actually matter for American
politics. Let's do it. Tell me, do they matter?
You know, Irving Kristol's argument was always that you could seed an idea and that it would then influence the culture. And if you look at the way the neoconservatives operated prior to the second Gulf War, it does seem like he was onto something, because they had a coherent theory of the case for Iraq, and they managed, you know, a small ideological group did manage to push its ideas. I think you see the same thing today with Trump, really. It is true that Trump himself is not an intellectual, but you always need a horse who can carry these ideas. And I see Trump as the logical culmination, some ways, of what Buckley was propounding, but closer to the Irish, well, closer to someone like Pat Buchanan, who kept these far right, or what we call far right. They're actually were mainstream right ideas before World War I. And they were just, to some extent, suppressed after World War II. But so, yeah, I think ideas, I think they can matter a lot in American politics.
You know, Buckley had this great verb he used to use all the time, and it came out of his Catholic teaching, anathematize. He'd say, well, you know, they're anathematizing us all the time. And I think this is what we're talking about with the Times, when some of its journalists or its editors can be so dismissive of the more ideological components of our politics. And this, I guess, Jacob, is where we get to this idea that when we're talking about concepts or theories on the one hand and actual on-the-ground politics on the other, and who comes first and who comes after, what I began to realize was, it's not new, nothing I ever come up with is really new, is that it's really the politicians who drive, who see something, they sense something in the electorate, they're able to make an appeal, and then the intellectuals kind of line up behind them or form a phalanx, a kind of orbit around them. This is why I've been suggesting to people, don't look just at President Trump. He's very hard to take your eyes off of. I mean, even now we're only beginning to recognize the political genius. We don't like to talk about it that way. It makes us uncomfortable. But the instincts are like beyond comparison. There's no one who comes close. Raskin said that to me. He said he has great political instincts, and they cut in all sorts of ways. So, right. Well, then the idea people and the writers and the journalists, the propagandists, in the time I write about, mid-century period, the term publicist was still used that way. Our good friend Michael Lind still uses the term publicist that way. Someone who promotes the argument. That was Buckley's genius. You know, he could take the idea and turn it into something people understood. I've noticed where there are a few, you know, I'm very happy with the interest in my book. I've noticed a few seem to think I am somehow insulting Buckley when I quote one of his professors saying he was very good at talking about books he hadn't read. Jacob, that's the story of almost every journalist, beginning with Walter Lippmann. We never have time to read the books. We get a little bit from them. And Buckley had the instincts of a politician. He was a listener. He's a pretty good musician, right? You respect that. You're a musician. You know Buckley's prose is very musically based. You get that. I mean, you know a lot about it. And he came to English late. So he read very slowly, as many good writers do, including John Updike, one of my idols, so he's processing things in his own way, and he's picking up the gist of the argument really well. And once you get to the gist, how much more do you really need to know? You know, how many layers of nuance do you need to have? And I think in that sense, someone like Trump has his tremendous instincts. You know, one of my favorite moments in a really good book, I hope listeners remember, Devil's Bargain, Josh Green's really good book on the first election. It's really about the partnership of Bannon and Trump. And there's an early moment, it's a prologue. So this is about was published in 2017, I think. And there's a prologue, which is, I think, set in the Trump Tower when the returns are coming in 2016. And after a while, they begin to realize he may actually win. And so I think it's Chris Christie and others think, here's their opportunity. And they begin laying out in these sophisticated kind of bean counting ways what's going on politically. And Trump just has one question. Did Obama win there in 2012? You know, like they'll say, well, look, we're seeing a shift in Ohio. And Trump will say, Did Obama win that in 2012? He's cut to the core. Of. He knows if he wins those precincts, the ones Obama got in 2012, he's going to be elected president. He does not need six people telling him what the theory of elections is. And that's where I think you get to the Burnham argument, the Buckley argument, that the first 2,000 names in the phone book, kind of the common sense argument. It's not to be dismissed as lightly as many choose to do. And sometimes when I hear really respected analysts, foreign policy or domestic people, domestic policy experts on television, I watch one program or another, I read about it, they still use this kind of antiquated language. You know, they talk about the orthodoxies and the norms of the office. And all I'm thinking of, really, orthodoxies and norms. Let's talk about Franklin Roosevelt's third term.
There never has been such a thing as the presidency.
Yes, I like this. Yeah, tell me, you said this the other day. I really liked it.
I think each, you know, the more ambitious presidents, it's stretch the office in ways that they consider appropriate. Whether, look at what Woodrow Wilson did. My God. I mean, first you had the progressive reforms, and then he essentially constructs a proto-national security state.
Yeah.
Once we enter World War I, you know, Wilson is the father of the Cold War in many ways.
In many ways. Yeah.
And, you know, there was a retrenchment that took place after World War I, but Wilson really had magnified the stature of the office. So did TR. You know, FDR walks in there and runs four times. They were calling him an American Caesar. They thought he'd never leave. Tried to pack courts, yep. You know, vast expansion of government domestically. And then in World War II, in comes Truman. So I don't buy this argument that there's some model that you have to adhere to if you become president. The really ambitious presidents just go for it.
Look at Abraham Lincoln. I think our guy Wilmore Kendall had a line about Lincoln. Lincoln was the Caesar Lincoln feared. You know, he became his own Caesar. He thought he had to do it during the Civil War. There's something else that's interesting that just kicked around in my head for a long time. I don't know what to do with it. So I recommend it to your very smart listeners for thought. In Henry Adams's fascinating novel, Democracy, which is, look, it's not a great work like his, you know, his epic history of the Jefferson and Madison presidencies or other works that he wrote. But there's a very interesting chapter where he talks about rigged elections in 1864. And this wizened, wise man senator makes the case to the heroine of the novel, it's a woman, that there are certain times when you want to rig an election. And he invents this idea that in Michigan, the Republican Party had to rig the outcome to make sure McClellan did not defeat Lincoln. And then he says to the heroine, says, so what would you do? You think that was a mistake? What if the election had put the wrong guy in office? Then one of my favorite moments is in Game Change, you know, the first of these kind of tell-all gossipy recent backstage presidential books we're getting. If you look at the early pages where Heilman and Halperin are describing the Iowa caucus, and Hillary and Bill Clinton, 2008, can't believe Obama won. And they have a passage where they quote the things Bill and Hillary Clinton say to the campaign, said, no way those Iowa voters voted for Obama. They bust them in from Illinois. I know it. The numbers don't work. There are not enough people in Iowa to do that. This whole thing is a setup. Then at the very end, Bill Clinton says, it's a rigged deal, right?
Democracy by Henry Adams offers, as to use the kind of language Buckley would employ, a salutary or even salubrious reminder of the depraved conditions of American democracy. And that is an acidulous look at the state of America. I mean, it is filled with corrosive observations. it's a cynical, dour look at the American Republic. And I think it offers us a reminder now that Trump is not an aberration, and that maybe this Cold War era, where we pretended to be more of a goody-two-shoes country, was in fact the aberration.
Yeah, well, that's an argument several have made. And I would add two layers to it. Gary Wills pointed out, I think it was in 1998, right around just before the Lewinsky scandal broke, he wrote a fantastic piece for the New York Times, Sunday Magazine, called Whatever Happened to Politics. And Wills really goes after this idea of a leadership class, an elite class. And he said, actually, the progress of America is toward egalitarianism. He said, except in this period during the Cold War, when we have these wise men who are telling everybody what to do. So David Halberstam writes, you know, that important book, The Best and the Brightest. That's what it's about. David Halberstam's book is a vindication of what Buckley said about the 2,000 names in the telephone directory. That when you choose your exalted, enlightened leaders and give them free rein, they are no longer part of a functioning democratic republic. I was struck when Buckley and his brother, his older brother James, who was a senator from New York, the first conservative party candidate ever elected to high office, he gets elected senator from what then, 1970, was either the first or second largest state in the union. New York and California had comparable populations. And it's James Buckley who is the first conservative Republican to say Nixon should resign after Watergate. And James Burnham, it's all in the book. James Burnham drafted the statement, and Jim Buckley was a lawyer and worked it out with him. And Bill Buckley was the one who brought them together and said, we have to do something. Nixon's gone too far. He's losing popular support. The Saturday Night Massacre has happened, all this stuff. And when he makes his statement, James Buckley says, it is time for our ruler to voluntarily step down. And I'm thinking, ruler, what kind of country are we living in? Well, we're living in a country, it was said all those years before, I think in Lincoln's time, that elects a monarch every 4 years. I think that was the term, right?
Well, that was why this No Kings rally was so funny, because actually America could use, you know, if you had a there's nothing wrong with a constitutional monarchy. It helps diffuse some of the issues that we're seeing now, which is we have fused what Walter Badgett called the dignified and efficient offices, which is we have the president occupies, he's both prime minister and president. You know, he's both the ceremonial and the practical politician. And when you see someone like Trump, you know, maybe we put too much, we really have made the presidency too powerful now.
Well, and didn't, if I remember, speaking of that Badgett argument, that Woodrow Wilson really wanted to do that in that famous book, Congressional Government, right? He actually argues that the president should be more like a prime minister and handpick a few people from the Senate and put them in his cabinet.
And have a cabinet kind of government.
Yeah. Yeah. So these, and it's funny when these ideas are brought up, it's always, there's a kind of shocked response. And what's funny about that is exactly what you said, because presidents are violating the Constitution almost continuously. There's a great moment from the Korean War in 1950 when the leader of the isolationist right and the consistently defeated Republican hopeful for president, Robert Taft, said, Truman can't send our troops, you know, under the guidance of the UN to fight in Korea. He says, Congress has to approve this. This is illegal. And who defends what Truman did? Just the way Bret Stephens defended Trump in Iran. Arthur Schlesinger Jr. wrote a long letter, I think it was published in the Wall Street Journal, citing every instance where presidents violated the Constitution and said, see, you're allowed to do it. No, you're not, Arthur. Just because people break the law all the time, it doesn't mean you're allowed to break it too. And yet, in practical, pragmatic terms, that's where the argument leads you. Yeah, presidents are doing this constantly. And by the way, as we know, we talk about this kind of halcyon of a consensus politics during the mid-20th century. Well, ask the Cubans and the Chileans, right? Ask the Nicaraguans what they think of America as the great defender of open and fair elections and of freely elected leaders and self-determination. They tried to murder Castro. They tried over and over to do it. It goes all the way back. Howard Hunt, the Watergate guy, was first doing these psychological warfare propaganda campaigns in Guatemala. We did the same thing in Iran and never stopped haunting us. We talk about, here's an interesting thing where we say, well, Iran, you have to go back to 1979 when there was a religious revolution. And they brought the supreme leaders in. But it goes back earlier than that. We know that goes back to 1953 when they pushed Mossadegh out and brought in the Shah himself, who's a dictator. We did that.
Now, what's so interesting today, you were talking about figures in American politics who back then who were sticking to their principles. And you have the same phenomenon on the right today among the portion of the right. Seems to me that Steve Bannon is actually one of the more has some of the more interesting and incisive things to say about what's happening in American politics today, particularly on the eve of what Trump is calling the 12-day Iraq War. Kurt Mills at the American Conservative, they adhered to what they believed. They were very condemnatory of Trump's moves, while some others who have a more lickspittle character, such as Charlie Kirk, were expressing their approbation for Trump's moves. So do you think that, is this a consistent theme on the right, that there are people people on the right in the Buckley crowd who stuck to what they believed when you were talking about going up against Nixon? And then there are people on the right today that are, again, more interested in advancing their principles than necessarily trying to butter up Trump.
Yeah, there seem to be. Yes, it's interesting to see how there are always those few maverick figures and who also seem immune from real punishment or penalty dealt to them. It's interesting. It's partly because I'm thinking of someone like Massey or Rand Paul. Rand Paul's trickier, but they kind of create these personae for themselves as eccentrics, and somehow they're left alone. But they're very direct in the things they'll say. Even if the principles they're defending are not principles I might subscribe to, you have to admire the directness of it. And it certainly happened. Like you sent me, told me some of the things Kurt, your protege, your very bright protege said about Iran. I mean, they mean business. Tucker Carlson means business about it. They're not kidding. No, they oppose this stuff. And Bannon, who at one point I knew a little bit, I talked to him once or twice for a story I did. And, it's funny. I asked him if I could send him a copy of the Buckley book. I never heard from him. I thought he'd find aspects of it interesting, including a Catholicism. I would say
Steve Bannon, if you're listening.
Yes, right. Read my book.
Read Sam's book.
I'll even send you the PDF if you just want to do word searches. But I think the religious component is always worth looking at. And one reason, as we know, Gary Wilson is such a gigantic figure. I mean, there are many reasons. But one is he was one of the first really serious modern historians to say, you have to know what church somebody was raised in. You have to know what books they read, because those form the background and the culture. I'm surprised even now there's not more done on the president, the current president's having come through Norman Vincent Peale's church. Now, that's interesting because the Marble Church in Manhattan, that's a kind of, Reformed Protestantism. It's interesting there because there was a strong anti-Catholic component there. And yet so much of the movement is really an alliance of devout Catholics or observant Catholics and evangelicals. And they formed a kind of new bond. It probably goes back to the abortion issue and maybe even the AIDS backlash. You know, some people have traced this in pretty interesting ways. The stuff is all out there. And what it brings us back to, Jacob, is this idea that politics, a lot of it is about kind of affect and feeling. And I think Orwell even says this in his Burnham essay. He says, if you look closely at Burnham, what he's really writing about is not Burnham's famous book, although he brings it in, The Managerial Revolution. He quotes it all the time. And the second book, which in some ways is superior, The Machiavellians, which is about how power works in a democracy. But the essay that agitated him was Burnham's essay, Lenin's Heir, which was published, I think, in 45 in Partisan Review, when Burnham was still a figure on the left. And what he said, and what Orwell says, well, if Stalin's really Lenin's heir, why doesn't Burnham show us how Stalin's policies reflect Lenin's? He says he doesn't say anything about that at all. No, because that's not what it's about. It's not about whether you have a 5-year plan or an 8-year plan. No, it's about the mood, the surrounding mood, the culture of politics. And this is where the conversation also often gets lost. This is why people think a figure like, say, Milton Friedman was this hugely influential figure. And we know these acquaintances of ours on the right, this newish right, have absolutely no use for him. I mean, he's really, if you read American Affairs, Julius Krein's magazine, where you read Mike Lind, you know, very bright, thoughtful people, extremely erudite, they have no use for any of those arguments because they see them as being very little, differing very little from the mainstream economic arguments of the time. And instead, what they want is the disruption that's only going to come from somebody who comes in and ignores all the wisdom, all the conventional wisdom, as Galbraith called it, and is ready to shake things up and be, as Buckley called himself, a radical conservative. And so when I think of Kurt, our friend Kurt Mills, he strikes me as a radical conservative. And that begins in the idea that liberals, as Buckley had, liberals control everything. They control the media, they control the universities, they control the government. So you have to blow it up. You have to find the guy who will blow it up. Do you think that's
true? Sam, are we? Yes, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, but I'm wondering now, you know, the conservatives have blown it up or are in the process of blowing it up. Can they, in fact, establish their own hegemony as the FDR liberals did for 40 to 50 years? Or do you believe that the Trump movement is a transient epiphenomenal one?
Well, the Trump movement itself could be. That is to say, and our friend David Frum, whom we saw the other night, has made a good point for a long time, that we tend to overinterpret elections. Right. So we look at 2024 and we say, that's it, game over. Well, the same thing could happen in 2026. All the Democrats have to do is win the House and suddenly, right, the president and the administration could be stalemated.
Well, doesn't that give Trump a direct foe to battle against and gives his presidency a raison d'etre?
It could very well be.
Treacherous socialist Marxist scum have infiltrated the House. I need to battle them to uphold the virtue of the American Republic and so forth.
Absolutely, it could. And then the question will come back to the one you raised early on, which is delivering the goods, you know. That is to say, if all these, you know, the misery index is starting to look more miserable, and you have all those voters in the middle who don't know what they want to do, whom they favor, because they're not particularly ideological, as very shrewd observers going all the way back to Buckley's time, like his brother-in-law, Brent Bozell, saw. No, people aren't ideological. You have to guide them towards to embrace some idea. Well, it's possible, or argument, it's possible, yes, that could become the next phase of embattlement for the administration, but it could also really just, you know, bottle things up as well. That may be the reason they want so much to push through this new budget before time runs out in them, right? Isn't that kind of what's going on here?
Yeah. Sam, one of the most constituent parts of the Trump presidency has been the constant lying. And you made a remark, I think, on the NPR show On Point. I was looking, I actually read through the transcript of your lucubrations on that show.
I think ramblings is the word we're looking for.
Be more accurate. And I was going to use another Buckleyism, which was you said that, you know, it's one thing to have counter arguments, but it's another, you didn't use this word, but I will, in honor of Buckley, to stray into the region of taradiddles, which is outright fabrications. Can you expand upon that?
Well, I mean, now we're getting into the whole rhetoric of politics. And what do I think about that? I think it's all too easy for any observer of politics like myself. I mean, you're kind of an idea guy, so you work through strategy. You know, I read all your stuff, what's going on in Israel or Germany and all this, and learn a good deal about it. And to me, it's just, well, what are my neighbors saying? And what did I read last night? And I think the idea of truth and falsehood really does get complicated when we're talking about politics. Here's an answer I would make if I were on the other side. Someone said, well, so what do you make of all these falsehoods from President Trump? I would say, you know what? He's not having to lie about how many people were being killed in Vietnam or Afghanistan. He's not having to lie. Now, he may be saying we won a 12-day war that we didn't, but at least it was, so far it's been 12 days. And I think the depth of mendacity and prevarication really runs so much through politics. And the idea that you keep track of every erroneous statement seems a little self-defeating to me. Again, I'm going to bring up Will's because I looked at a number of his columns.
I just want to interject. I think one of the things that has annoyed me in the Washington Post is they have this Pinocchio system. They have this reporter there. I think it's Glenn Kessler, who's devoted over a decade now to these fine discriminations, to one Pinocchio, two Pinocchio, three. It just seems picayune and nonsensical to me.
It really does. It really does. And it kind of misses what people do rhetorically. Here's another thing that I've thought about Donald Trump for a long time. And I think I wrote this back when I was doing stuff for the Brits, Prospect Magazine. He has a kind of emotional candor. And that's what people respond to. And if you are being emotionally candid, like you've a lot of therapy as I've done, and your therapist says, you know, try to be more honest about your feelings, I don't think anybody really questions that. And that's where the authenticity comes from. And that may matter more than whether he's getting all these other things right or whether he's fabricating and inventing and doing these things presidents before him have done, but maybe taking them to a further extent.
So you're saying authenticity matters more than sincerity?
Well, yes, is our, another hero, Lionel Trilling. Yes, I mean, that was his argument, as you know, that the era of sincerity, which is, you know, be true to one, to be true to oneself in the kind of Polonius Shakespeare way, into authenticity, which is to act out and to follow, be uninhibited, disinhibited. I think there's a lot to that, especially when we've reached this period, this phase, and I don't know where it began, of a kind of a censoriousness in the culture, a kind of intolerance of acceptable opinion. I was really struck at the Times again, had a piece on how one of the late night television hosts was shocked that Trump used the F word when he was speaking to the media the other day. Does anybody watch slow burn television series? You'll hear the F word spoken 100 times in a series. In fact, my wife, who comes out of movies in the theater, has a theory that it's actors who insert the F word because they can't emotionally deliver what the line means to say. So the way you assert anger, pain, displeasure is to throw an F word in all the time. And in fact, if you watch the foreign ones as we do, like we like the the Icelandic ones or from Denmark, you know, the Nordic ones. I'm always looking for these television programs where it's absolutely frigid outside. They're walking through glacial landscapes and their jackets are open and they don't have earmuffs on because they have to look good while they're supposedly freezing. Even there, we've seen several Polish series, they are using American curse words as part of the normal dialogue. So there you are reading the subtitles, and there's one word in each sentence you don't need the subtitle for. And suddenly we're offended that the president says that at a press conference or meeting with the media. And my response to that is, are you effing kidding me? That you're going to be pious and censorious about that? And that's where I see somebody who likes President Trump is going to say, oh, so these obscene people on television are offended that their president speaks obscenely. And that this is reported in my former newspaper as if it's worthy of anyone's interest or attention, and not in fact revealing of the utter vacuity of so much of our culture, gives me pause.
As we know, Saul Bellow referred to the Beatrix Potter prose of the New York Times.
Yeah, he had another one I really liked, the Tinker Toy prose. And I know what he means by that because I used to have to write it and edit it. Words have to come in a certain sequence. And so
it's very prissy.
And hey, and but who's
it,
being...
But yeah. It does work.
Yeah, oh, well, often it could be wonderfully lucid, you know, someone we both admire, and I think is a friend of yours, Peter Baker, is quite a fine writer. Some of the columnists are really good writers. I like David Sanger's reports. You know, I can get right through them. I know what he's saying. He brings great depth, command of his material. There are a lot of fantastic journalists out there, just as there are these really great, smart, ideological thinkers who terrify me because they know so many things I know I'm never going to learn or never be able to just to comprehend at the level they do. I don't know where it comes from. I don't know whether that the people around me have always been smarter than me and I've just gotten older, or whether young people really are smarter. My older brother, who is now retired, but quite good cognitive scientist, says, no, young people are smarter. Their brains work better. They analyze problems better. They come out of a STEM culture they're more conversant with. And he says that he was quite an original researcher in his area of linguistics, they used to call it. And he says he doesn't have anything to teach the young ones. They know more than he does. And that's how I feel about some of these young journalists.
Well, devoting much of your career to studying the right, as you and I have done, may lead some to question our mental capacities. But I found it to use what another sort of Buckleyism, a fructifying field of inquiry. But Sam, I want to thank you. We have not reached Andrew Sullivan-like lengths here. Yeah, I think you went on for what, 2.5 hours, 3 hours with it?
Yes, and I got an email from this wonderful NPR interviewer, Meghna Chakrabarty, who did the On Point. And we really hit it off. And she sent me a note and she said, do I have Andrew Sullivan envy? She said, you bet I do. I want to go on for 3 hours too, but they won't let me. Yeah, once you get on this roll and you forget there's an audience so we can say whatever we like. How long have we gone on here, Jacob?
About an hour. So I would like one last thing. How far to draw on your New York Times op-ed? To what degree do you think that Donald Trump is the heir of William F. Buckley?
I'm still trying to figure it out, actually, which sounds like an evasion because it is. I didn't know when I was writing the book. And I know some have objected to that or been, you know, disappointed that I didn't bring the story up to the present. And I am reluctant, you know, that great phrase of Heine's or somebody about, you know, backward looking prophecy that historians are really susceptible to, particularly unprofessional historians like me. I mean, you know, I'm not a certified historian, looking back and saying, well, what would a man who died at the age of 82 in 2008 think of Donald Trump and all these years later? And how much would he recognize? I think that's the question. And at one point, I did have a discussion of that in the book and raised a question. And I had an introduction where I worked through some of this. And then I thought, I just don't want to do that. I think you try to recreate the life and be suggestive so a reader can infer.
I think your approach was correct in the book. I actually think it was a wise decision not to make it hostage to the current moment, because the book will endure much longer in its current configuration.
Well, one hopes so.
But that does not alleviate you of the responsibility to answer my question.
No, it does not.
Which is separate from your book.
I know.
And I am actually curious, just your own personal view.
My own personal view is, for so long, and you wrote exceptionally well about this in connection with my book, and some others have too, a very interesting, brilliant thinker, Charles King, or an interesting piece in Foreign Affairs, which I've just seen, that gets into the same point you and a couple of others have, which is to say, and Christopher Buckley, who's a friend of yours and mine, brilliant writer, said this about his father too. You know, what if he's a sorcerer's apprentice, really? What if he's the guy who opens the lid? He finds this thing. He gets this idea. He has this brilliant insight that you could recast all these ideological disputes as a kind of cultural conflict. So you reposition where everybody is. You draw the strands together. You make it a politics of oppositionism and all this stuff. And then the lid is open, and who knows what's going to come out of it. And that is what I'm beginning to think, not only as I reflect on it, but because people are making really thoughtful observations about my subject in a way that, you know, me, just the kind of savant, you know, the idiot savant storyteller type, doesn't really get. And but the critics come in and they see these things that, oh, I think you're right, you know, that is in the book, you know. And so it makes me think, I still ask the question, would he recognize Trump? I heard Trump's name mentioned once. He wrote a piece about him in 1990, and we all know that, and you can look it up. And I didn't include it because you can't say that what one man writes about another in 1990 is going to mean anything all these years later, because look what happened with National Review and Trump. They changed their mind within months. So that didn't seem fair. But I heard the name Trump once, and it was when, that I remember, it was when we, my wife, Kathy, and I were at Bill and Pat Buckley's house in Stamford, Connecticut. And Pat, who was always on the phone organizing some event or other, had gotten off the phone with Blaine Trump. And Blaine Trump is not a Trump you think about a lot. But she's part of the larger family. And I thought, okay, this is a world where people they know one another. But the other thing I would say, Jacob, was very simple. Donald Trump was never on firing line. There were 1,500 episodes of it. And the bar was not that high. Here's how I'm going to clinch the point. I was on firing line once, for heaven's sake. And Trump wasn't. So you're thinking, well, what does that mean? Did Buckley not want him? Or did Trump not want to go near him? I don't know the answer to that question. So as you're well aware, and others have observed this, Trump appears in the book one time in its 1,000 pages. And that's when he and Bill Buckley were both character witnesses for their good mutual friend, Roy Cohn. And I think that gets us to some of what we're talking about. Buckley had a weakness, if not a tropism, word he would have used, for what the great critic Dwight McDonald identified early on as low company. And that's a theme throughout his life. You know, what you doing with this guy? What's he doing with that guy? What's he doing defending E. Howard Hunt during Watergate? What's he doing saying Joe McCarthy is the heir to the abolitionists? What's he doing defending, as he did for a long time, Spiro Agnew? You know, why is this going on? There's some kind of attraction, I think, you know? And this is, of course, what we're back to Orwell and his famous essay about Burnham, that, no, they're attracted to these kind of thuggish people. Maybe does that grow out of a distrust of democracy? Maybe. So you have to have the thug, the tough guy. I don't know. But there is this sense that you think, well, Buckley found the way and the others kind of follow. And maybe we know that Trump was very aware of William Buckley because, you know, he mentioned him in that debate in a very pointed and impressive way. I remember people sitting up when he said that, when Ted Cruz says, well, not too many conservatives coming out of Manhattan, and Trump fires back at him, oh, really? What about William F. Buckley? It was a shock when he said that he knew that. Even if he knows only the name, nevertheless, he knew the name. So you think, okay, yeah, there may be a connection there. Politics is a mood, it's an atmosphere, all these things. And maybe they're in the same part of it. I don't really know. They inhabit the same universe. It's not the same moral universe, but a kind of a universe of sentiment or feeling. It may not be all that separate.
Sam, I think Sorcerer's Apprentice gets uncomfortably close to the truth. And maybe it even provides the title for this very podcast. Thank you for your lucid and clear exposition today. And it was wonderful to talk with you again.
It's always great to talk to you, Jacob. Thanks a lot.